Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of economic analysis focusing on the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, incomes, debts, prospects, prices, all of it. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities here in the United States. Currently, I teach at the New School University in New York City. I want also to tell you that I write columns for a variety of publications, but the one where you can see me most regularly is Truthout, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis. Take a look at them at truthout.org. If this program, our analyses, interest you, please know that we maintain two websites available to you 24/7 and without any charge. On these websites, you can get the complete archive of all of our radio programs over the 3 years that we have been producing them. You can see also media interviews I do, lectures I give, all kinds of material, even entire semesters of classes that I teach, if these are of interest to you, as well as links to materials you will find interesting. Please note these two websites and make use of them. rdwolf with two Fs .com and democracyatwork.info. Not only do they have all the materials I just mentioned, but both of these websites will allow you to do two things in addition. One, communicate with us. Tell us what you like and don't like about this program. Pose questions toward the end of every program. We answer one or two that we select from the many that we get. And the other thing you can do is follow us. That is, click on the icon on either website, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Before we get started for today, I want to also let you know and remind you, in a sense, of something we did last week. I had Seth Adler, the conference coordinator of the Left Forum, here, and in the opening minutes of the program, he discussed the exciting plans and programs and speakers and panels that will be part of the 4,000 and 5,000 people that gather at the John Jay School of the City University of New York the last weekend in May, May 30, 31st, and June 1. Please consider, if you're in the area and have the time, to go to the largest annual collection of liberal, progressive, radical thinkers and activists, professors and politicians, every kind of person who shares a notion that this country can and should do better than it's doing. It's an exciting time. I go each year. I'm proud to be part of it. I will be participating myself, but if you are interested, please take a look at leftforum.org. All your information, directions, registration, it's all there gathered for you. Okay, turning to the updates for today, I want to begin with a piece of research done by an old friend of mine. His name is Gordon Laffer, L-A-F-F-E-R. And he's a professor at the University of Oregon on the west coast of the United States. And he was commissioned to do a study by the Economic Policy Institute, a well-known think tank in Washington, D.C. And indeed, you can get his report that I'm going to refer to by going to the website of the EPI.org, where you will be able to follow their interesting work on a number of topics, but Professor Gordon Laffer's research. His study was a study of charter school companies, in particular the Rocket Ship School program, and its privatization of the schools, of many schools, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So we have a professor who's a specialist at this, evaluating private charter schools in the city of Milwaukee and writing up his evaluation for the EPI. I don't have the time, but I'm not going to summarize a very complicated and interesting and comprehensive report. But basically, his conclusions are the following. The performance, the educational performance of students in charter schools, especially when you look over a number of years and don't pick one or the other year, or not necessarily the first year, are no better than the public schools, which is doubly critical because they can pick and choose who they take in. They can do all kinds of things public schools are not allowed to do, and they still can't get a better performance. Number two, he points out that they are driven by the desire for private profit, many of them, and this rocket ship company is clearly a case in point. And we should remember that it's one thing to build a school where your goal is profit, and it's another thing to build a school where you don't need to make profit because your goal is education. And his report demonstrates how real and urgent that difference remains. But finally, in my own estimation, reading the report, I am reminded of the basic lesson about charter schools, that they're about cheap. The charter school is the way that those who control urban society in America, and that's not the local politicians and it's not the voters, but it's the same pyramid of big corporations and high-paid executives that functions everywhere in our society to run the show. They don't want to have to pay the taxes that would be needed to fund the quality education that could really raise everybody to the kind of standard of living and earning that we want. They don't want to pay those taxes. So they're looking for a way to continue to pretend at education at a lower cost. And the real interest in charter schools is that, allowing education to be done more cheaply, while pretending to everyone that spending less on education doesn't compromise the quality of the education. To which I respond, as I hope most of you will, good luck, ain't gonna happen. Let me turn to a remarkable legal case that was decided at the end of April, but that I think hasn't got anywhere near the attention it deserved, and so I want to bring it to you, my listeners and viewers, because it's an important lesson in how our economic system works. The defendants in the lawsuit were the following four companies. Perhaps you've heard of them: Apple Computer, Google, Intel, and Adobe. I'm sure you've heard of them. They were defendants in something called a class action suit. That's a suit brought by a few people, but on behalf of a larger group, all of whom are asserted to have the standing because they've been damaged to bring a suit. Okay, who brought the suit? 60,000 people, mostly engineers, that had been or may still be employed by Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe. 60,000 members of the class. What was the case? Well, there's all kinds of information about this, but I'm taking my information from one source so that if you'd like to check it, as sometimes people have asked me, let me tell you what that source is so you can check it to your heart's content. I take my information from a source that few would question in terms of my biases, Forbes magazine. Tim Warstall, spelled W-O-R-S-T-A-L-L, wrote an op-ed on the 27th of April in Forbes magazine. And so you can find it there. And that's where my information comes from, but I have taken the time to check it, and what Tim Warstall wrote there is correct. A settlement was reached in this class action lawsuit. The charge was that Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe had conspired to keep down the wages and salaries paid to their engineers. And the case asserted that the way they had done that is to enter into agreements, explicit or implicit, that none of these companies would hire an engineer away from the other. In other words, if you're working for a company and you're not happy with the conditions of your employment and you want a better salary, a better job situation, And you go to your employer, which is normally how this is done, and you say, I think I'm worth more money than you're paying me. I'd like to be paid more. And they tell you, no, we're not going to do that. You can say to them politely, okay, well, then I'm going to go and look at one of the other large employers in the area who hire people, engineers like me, and I'm going to work for them because I think I can get a better job paying me what I'm worth. This couldn't be done by engineers in this area because there was an agreement among Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe not to hire engineers that had left one or the other of them, and never to compete, never to poach, as Steve Jobs was quoted as having said, never to poach an engineer from one another. And the engineer said what in effect this did is undermine their capacity to get higher wages, to force the different companies, here we go now, to compete for workers in the way that a normal market competition would have them do. In other words, there was a conspiracy among these four companies to repress the wages their engineers could otherwise, in an open system that didn't have this conspiracy, to repress the wages they otherwise might have enjoyed. Okay. The case was argued, was about to go to trial, and as often happens, these four companies likely decided that a trial would get the exposure to what they had done, the flagrantly anti-competitive behavior, being unwilling to compete in the market for the services of engineers, and if an engineer was good, to have him be able or her to be able to get a higher pay by saying to the people, who's willing to pay me more given what I do? None of that could happen. These engineers were damaged. And had there been a trial, there would have been lots of public exposure of this anti-competitive behavior by Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe. They didn't want, apparently, to have their reputations tarnished by anything so unpleasant as the truth. So a settlement was reached before the trial began. And now I want to tell you about the settlement. The four companies agreed to pay a kind of penalty of $324 million. Had the case gone to trial, and had those companies been found guilty, they would have had to pay $3 billion and possibly, because there's normally a tripling of damages, as much as $9 billion. So settling in advance certainly was saving what they might have had to pay. Although, of course, had they won the case, they wouldn't have had to pay anything. Well, how much does this come to? Well, here's how you do that. $324 million spread, let's assume equally, among the 60,000 members of the class, works out to $5,400 per engineer. Since they had been prevented for years from getting higher salaries, since these people get salaries typically in the $100,000 a year, or at least many of them do, this amount of a payout, $5,400, doesn't begin to compensate these engineers for all that they lost through the non-competitive behavior of these companies. By the way, in the European Union, the law is different. Any company found guilty of doing what Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe did could be fined as much as 10% of the company's global annual turnover. That would be many, many, many billions of dollars for Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe. Lucky they're in the United States. Lucky they've got the laws arranged for their own benefit. Lucky they could get the lawyers to do all their bidding. Lucky they could impose on these engineers something as little as $5,400 for years of discrimination. But I want to add another point beyond what the obvious here is. The next time you hear a leading executive of a major corporation particularly if he or she comes from Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe, telling you about the marvels of competition and how they're all about competition and how all they ask is for competition to be allowed so they can make an honest buck. Please remember what this case was about to get a proper understanding of the depth of commitment to competition among corporations who, in fact, spend a great deal of their time and energy figuring out how to get around, underneath, and evade competition. Last short update from today is really a kind of piece of information. There is a company active in real estate who's led by a man named Zell. His first name is Sam Zell, and he's the head of something called Equity Residential, one of the largest home builders and home maintenance companies. And he has been trying to understand what's going on in the housing market from the point of view of someone who makes billions off of it. And he says, here's what I see, and I want all of us to understand it. Home ownership in the United States has been falling and continues to fall. In the Great Recession, as we call the last 6 years of economic catastrophe, owners of about 5 million homes lost their properties to foreclosure, while tight lending made homes harder to buy. Wow. Meanwhile, the median age of marriage rose over these years from 26.1, age of the woman getting married, to 28.2. That may seem like a little, but it's a very big postponement of marriage. And basically, the bottom line that this man wants us to understand about the housing market is this. Americans are not buying homes. They can't afford them. They are shifting to rentals that they can afford. It's the end of the dream of Americans to own their own home. The direction of change is going the other way. Not more people saving up and buying a home. People giving up, people shifting to rental. So what Mr. Sam Zell is saying with great enthusiasm is the market is great for building rental houses. We're going to be building houses that have apartments in them for people who can't afford their own home and who have to pay out rent. And remember the meaning of that. When you buy your own home, even if you buy it with a mortgage, the money you pay out every month is slowly building your own share of the house and diminishing slowly the share of the bank from whom you borrow. When you rent, you just pay out and pay out. And every month that you pay your rent, you don't acquire a rising share of your home. You have no share in your home. You will leave nothing to your children from that home. When you stop paying rent, you leave and no property accrues to you. Mr. Zell is excited about a shift from home ownership to rental, but the rest of us cannot share the enthusiasm of the profiteer for obvious reasons. I want to turn now to a discussion with you of the first of our major topics for the program today. And this was occasioned by a communication from one of you that I thought was exceptionally thoughtful. I mean, all your questions are good. We use an enormous amount of the material you send us to produce a better program. But this one was particularly thoughtful, I thought. Here was the point this questioner raised. He said, you talk, meaning me, you talk a lot about the difference between a capitalist enterprise and a workers' cooperative enterprise. And that's well and good, and I understand what you're saying. But you're leaving out something, or maybe even worse, you're leading your listeners and viewers to perhaps equate, make the same, a capitalist enterprise and an enterprise in which a person is self-employed, works by himself or herself. You know, think of an individual doctor or an individual lawyer or an individual architect or an individual caterer or an individual lawn sweeper. It really doesn't matter. And I thought that's a correct question, that a proper way to understand the different ways enterprises can be organized has to include not only the capitalist enterprise, shareholders, board of directors, mass of employees, and not only the worker co-op, where the mass of employees become their own directors, where they make a cooperative and democratic enterprise. There has to be recognition that between those two, or different from those two, is a third and different kind of enterprise. And this is a good point, because that has been true for thousands of years. There have always been, in all societies, individuals who were either interested in, or able, or provoked, for God knows what reason, to set up an enterprise individually, by themselves. They're not cooperating with somebody else, they're not employing somebody else, and they're nobody's employee unless you count them themselves, they're self-employed. And in many societies, there are large numbers of these people. For example, in the United States, we have some millions of them. They're not the dominant way we organize business in this country, far from it. They are a minority of business in terms of the work that gets done, the people doing the work. A minority of us are self-employed. And in many ways, being self-employed is difficult. On the other hand, certain trends in society produce more self-employment. For example, recently, we have had an action in which many capitalist enterprises have, for their own reasons, stimulated the growth of self-employment. Here's the basic phenomenon. Big capitalist enterprises have had to negotiate with labor unions, let's say, over the years, or compete with companies where there are labor unions, even if they don't have them themselves, and they've had to give their workers certain benefits, vacation time, medical coverage, perks of various kinds, help to your child to get into college, or whoever knows what the benefits are, pension and so forth. And the capitalists, always looking to make more profit, have said to themselves, wait a minute. Suppose we fired the worker to whom we have to pay not just a salary and a wage, but also to pay for the medical program and the pension benefits and so on. And we say to them, you're no longer working here. But if you'd like, we'll hire you back, but as an independent consultant. In other words, we're not going to put you on the books. We're not going to make you a payroll employee, because if we do, we have to pay all these benefits. Instead, we will work out a deal. We'll buy so many hours of your work from you. We're not going to give you benefits, nothing. We're just going to pay you for your work. You can do it at home, perhaps. You can do it on a schedule you like. Here's some nice benefits for you. But the capitalist is not thinking about benefits for the workers. The capitalist is thinking about profit maximization for his company. And he sees a way. What that does, he sees the way by doing that, by avoiding to pay for benefits, by converting workers from employees into independent consultants, self-employed people selling their services to the company rather than workers hired on by the company. And in that way, they have made millions of American workers into self-employed people. On the one hand, the workers like the independence that sometimes goes with this, but they suffer from not having the benefits that once were attached to the kind of work that they do. Self-employed people also have different interests from other enterprises. For example, they want all the help they can get from the government to be available to small self-employed enterprises. They're not so interested in the benefits of government that go to big corporations. So they're pushing the government to do the things that self-employed people need, and that puts them at odds with what other enterprise types need. In other words, they're their own kind of enterprise, have their own role to play in society, and are not, for example, in the position of constantly trying to figure out how to get more out of a worker. They're much less exploitative as a result of that. They don't have the same position, the same imperatives, the same pressures that a capitalist does to constantly figure out ways to get more profit, for example, by converting employees into independent contractors or independent consultants. And it's important, and I accept the criticism of my listener who wanted me to point out that this is an important group in many economies around the world today, in the United States as well, and that they have a different set of pressures, a different set of ways of working. They're not the big speculators. They're not. They don't play the kind of role in our culture that, other enterprises do. And that a proper assessment of the economy means that you have to recognize that there are at least three different kinds of enterprises. The collective democratic co-op, the capitalist hierarchical top-down, and then the self-employed. And they have their different logics, their different issues, their different problems, and their different kind of support and impact on the larger society. Let me turn then to a second topic that's related to this. We can only begin in the time we have before we take our mid-program break, but I think this is a topic that you will find interesting, and so I'll begin by telling you what's happening, and then when we return from the break, I'll go into what it means. One of the places in the world right now where cooperative enterprises are growing the fastest among all the countries of the world, the one country where they're growing, if not at the fastest rate, it's among the top two or three fastest places co-ops are growing, is in Cuba. That's right, Cuba, that island 90 miles from the shore of Florida. The Cuban economy is, by design, from the very top, Raul Castro, who replaced Fidel Castro at the top of the government of Cuba, is officially supporting, endorsing, financing, encouraging the formation of thousands of co-ops as a major initiative in the economic development of the Cuban economy. And I thought you might all be interested in why that is, in what it's doing to Cuba, and how it speaks to the old debates and discussions between capitalism and socialism and communism. Isn't it interesting that a country with a dominant communist party and the particular history that Cuba has would be making the decision now to foster cooperative enterprises among workers? And to pique your interest, because when we come back from the break, this is what we're going to talk about, I want to stress to you that the workers' co-ops being formed in Cuba are not state-owned or state-operated enterprises. They are, and this is official and documented a dozen ways, these are private enterprises. They are owned and operated by the workers who get together with help from the government to form these private enterprises. They're agricultural and industrial. They're manufacturing and they're retail. They're in the urban areas and they're in the rural areas. This is a remarkable social experiment in the mass creation of worker co-ops. And when we return from our break, in a minute or less, we're going to talk about what that means, what it implies, and what lessons we can draw from it. We're now going to take, as we always do in the middle of our program, a short break. Please stay with me and come back. We will continue. This is Richard Wolff. The program is Economic Update. Back with you shortly.
Stolen, that story, I'm gonna feel it.
Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. Once again, to remind you that if this program and others like it that we run every week strike you as worthwhile, you probably will get something from the two websites we maintain and update on a continuous basis. The first one is rdwolf2fs.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. They are available to you 24/7. They are free of charge. And in addition to providing you with all the links and information and follow-up and archive of our programs, there are two other things they enable you to do. One, to communicate to us what you like and don't like, criticisms, questions. Toward the end of each program, we ask and answer the questions you send us. We select. We can't possibly choose them all. Many too many come, and we are grateful for them, but we have to select as best we can. And you can communicate with us that way. And the second and final thing you can do on the websites is to follow us in social media. Both websites, just click on the icon, and you can follow us Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Before the break, we were talking about this phenomena sweeping Cuba, the formation with government support of private enterprises that are worker co-ops. The government requires them to be worker co-ops. Now, what is going on here? Well, in the explanations offered both by the Cuban government and by independent observers that are studying the phenomena, the Cuban government has made the decision that it has been in the past much too reliant on state enterprises. What do I mean by state enterprise? Well, it's an enterprise that's rather like our conventional capitalist enterprise, in the sense that a relatively small number of people make the basic decisions. They're the top managers of the company. But what's different is the company isn't owned by shareholders. There are no shares. There are no shareholders. There is no stock market where shareholders buy and sell shares from one another. Instead, the government owns the enterprise, and it selects state officials, people with a position in the government, to function in a way analogous to a board of directors of a private company. So instead of the worker in a business in Cuba being employed by a private capitalist employer, that person, that Cuban man or woman, is employed by the government in a government enterprise. And the decision of the Cuban leadership, a leadership which refers to itself as Marxist, socialist, and so on, is that they have been too reliant on state enterprises. They don't want to continue to do that. They want to diversify their economy. They may keep some major industries as state industries, but they don't want capitalism. They do not want to create, they're opposed to that, on ideological and philosophic grounds. They do not want to create a class of people who employ and a class of people who are employees. They don't want the employees to be working to produce a profit that a few individuals, the employers, get and decide how to use. That's out for the Cuban leadership, at least the leadership now. So if they're not going to have state enterprises, they don't want that, but they're not going to have capitalist enterprises, what are they going to have? And what they've chosen, you might call it a new path for Cuban socialism. It's the path of worker co-ops. The government is actively saying to people, we encourage you to move out of a job in the state sector, move away from working for the government as your employer, and instead, together with other Cuban citizens, we want you to form your own new enterprises. These enterprises will belong to you, not one or the other of you, all of you, as a co-op, as a collective of people choosing this way to earn a living. And it's sweeping Cuba. It's very popular, and so far it seems quite successful. And I think it begins to suggest something in the way of a lesson. First, that there is an alternative to an enterprise being either capitalist, private owners through shareholding, board of directors selected by them, mass of people who are told what to do, where to do it, how to do it, and who produce profits that the employer, a tiny minority, controls and decides what to do with. That there's an alternative between that capitalist enterprise and state-owned enterprises, which function the same, except that the people running the show are state officials, which they aren't in capitalism, private capitalism, and that the government is the owner, which you also don't have in private capitalism. What the Cuban experience begins to show us, it really is an alternative. And what's interesting is it's an alternative that's coming out of a state socialism, an alternative coming out of a state enterprise-dominated economy. Most of the examples of co-ops that I talk about on this program come from a private capitalist economy. It's people moving away from private capitalism into worker co-ops. What Cuba is an example of people moving away from state enterprise, state-governed socialism, into worker co-ops. And isn't it interesting that from the two opposites, there's a kind of parallel evolution focused on the worker co-op? It gives me more evidence than I already had that worker co-ops are what's happening now, are a little bit at least a wave of the future. How much we will see in the months and years to come. I think it's a recognition of the Cuban leadership that you can have a socialism that isn't all necessarily state. That in fact, the question whether it's private or the state is less important in Cuba now than the question, is it a top-down hierarchical enterprise, either private or state, versus is it a democratic, collective, cooperative enterprise? That difference is more important in Cuba now than the private versus public. And I think that's something we in the United States and many of my listeners in Europe, Asia, Australia, and around the world should ponder. We spend so much time in our societies in endless, and to me, largely fruitless, debates about whether it's better to be private or public. Should the state run it? Should the private entrepreneur run it? The Cubans are saying to us, that's not the important issue. Or at least they're saying to us, there's a much more important issue than that one. And that's the issue of, do we have a top-down hierarchical enterprise where the mass of people are alienated from, feel oppressed by the board of directors and the major shareholders in the case of private capitalism, the state officials and the government in the state of state, in the condition of state socialism? Maybe the way forward is not a debate either or between them, but something different from both of them. Something that is mostly about collective work, democratic decision making, where all the people who participate in making an enterprise successful together make the key decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits they all help to produce. I think the Cubans are on to something, and I think what they have discovered in their way bears a certain family resemblance to what the Spanish people in the Basque region discovered that made the Mondragon Corporation so successful. It's what those folks that I admire so much in the Bay Area of California, in the Arizmendi bakeries in the area there, what they've discovered, the viability, the desirability of collective democratic enterprises. Not that they don't have their own problems, of course they do. We're not talking about heaven. We're talking about a better way to live your working life. And I suspect that if this is something that the Spanish in the Basque area, that the young people and older people in the Bay Area of California, and now the folks of Cuba, if they're all finding their way to this at more or less the same time, guess what? Something important is going on. And I, for one, want to keep looking at it because I think there are lessons, important lessons, we can draw from it. In the final 5 minutes, I want to say something. It's brief and not adequate to the subject, which unfortunately is my problem in many of the things I talk about, that even though I can talk about them for 5 minutes, it would be very easy to talk about them for an hour or two because they deserve the attention and they're rich and complex in what they can teach us. One of you wrote me and said you want to take me to task, that I said on some program that there's never been an effort made on a society-wide basis to really try to build an economy around worker co-ops, around democratic, collective ownership, operation, and direction of enterprises. And the writer said to me, what about Yugoslavia under the Tito government from the end of World War II till the time that old Yugoslavia dissolved with the changes in Eastern Europe? Didn't they do that? And the answer to that good question, like the answer to many good questions, is a frustrating yes and no. Just no way out of it. Well, let's do the yes part, and then we'll do the no part, and then we'll come back in future programs, because what happened in Yugoslavia deserves close attention, especially if I'm right about the wave of the future being what is going on in Cuba, but elsewhere, more and more worker co-ops. So the yes part. The Tito government of Yugoslavia, unlike anyone else in Eastern Europe, did make a society-wide effort to erect worker co-ops, to reorganize the business of Yugoslavia in such a way that most enterprises were organized as worker co-ops. So that part is true. And in a way, it was a more ambitious effort than you had elsewhere. In Czechoslovakia, you had collective farms that went quite a long way. In parts of China, you had communes at a certain point, some of which moved honestly in that direction. In collective farms in the Soviet Union also. But it's correct that in Yugoslavia, it was more general. It was the society and the economy as a whole. And that was very impressive. So I should be corrected the way an alert listener did. But here now comes the no part of the answer. In order for it to work as a co-op, there has to be the agreement of the government to really allow the workers in an enterprise, perhaps together with the folks who live in the communities surrounding the enterprise, because they're interdependent. What happens in the enterprise depends on what the community is doing, and vice versa. But the top government, the central government, really has to allow the democratic decision-making at the base of society, in the individual enterprise, and in the surrounding communities, it has to let them be powerful. They have to make the basic decisions. And the central government can coordinate among them, or help that, sure. And it can make everybody aware of what's going on. But those are subordinate functions. The power and the basic decision, once you help everybody know what's going on, and once you coordinate, is still to be left in the units of enterprise and interacting communities. The critique of Yugoslavian collective enterprises, worker co-ops, was that the central government, for all kinds of reasons, this is not so much a critique as it is a description of what happened. The central government was so fearful of its survival, so concerned about outside interference, with good reason, that it really wasn't prepared to allow the actual power, economic power at the base, in the enterprise, and in the community to function. So you had the form, You had some of the reality, but you had one part of the story withheld. That is, the central government intervened, had its own people often within the enterprise who had more power than others because of their connection to the government, perhaps through the Communist Party and so on. You have to kind of let go. If you're going to have a workers' cooperative democracy, well, then you have to either do it or not do it. What Yugoslavia did was say, it's what we want to do, it's where we're going, but we're not quite yet able to risk a society that makes its decisions in the enterprise and in the surrounding communities with whatever coordination is needed among them. That's the step that was missing that makes the experience in Yugoslavia interesting, important, and definitely part of the story of worker co-ops, but also a situation where we have to say, no, there was something fundamentally insufficient and missing in that experiment. We have to kind of go further. And perhaps the most cautionary dimension of the Yugoslavian story is the message it sends to Cuba today, to the Cuban government. Are you really prepared to allow the flowering of worker co-ops that will become the real economic foundation and hence the real economic power of the Cuba of tomorrow? Giving up the old state socialism will be a struggle. Okay, in the final minutes remaining to us today, I would like to respond to a couple of your questions. And the first one has to do with a kind of provocation one of you sent to me. And it goes like this. What's wrong with bailing out big corporations when they need it? What's wrong with responding to corporations when they say they're going to have to leave and go to another country unless they get certain kinds of help which will make it possible for them to stay here? Okay, fair enough. Let me try to answer. Many corporations in the United States have demanded subsidies, accommodations, tax reductions over the years. In fact, it's a rare American corporation that hasn't demanded or gotten those kinds of assists. Let me give you examples you might not have thought of. A company approaches a city, a mayor, a governor, a congressperson, doesn't matter, and says, you know, we're thinking of settling in your area, but we're not going to do it because there really isn't a highway that runs near enough the land we have found. That's not a very subtle hint. And the mayor of the town who hears this is quick to say, in many cases, no problem. I will go to the state government, use my political pull, after all, I'm the mayor of an important city, and I'll get an extra part of the interstate built over in that area that you want. Won't cost you a nickel. I'll do it as part of the economic development in this area. Done, says the company. Okay, if we kept records in this society, we don't, by the way, and that's not an innocent oversight either. But if we kept records, we would list what that cost. That cost $6 million to build that stretch of road. That was $6 million of taxpayer money. That was $6 billion that wasn't spent on daycare for needy children or a hospital or a student loan program or a pre-K opportunity for toddlers, etc. It was a benefit, it was a subsidy, it was a help to a corporation. I think we have to pay attention to that. Not because it means we wouldn't help a capitalist corporation when it threatens to leave, but we would behave in a different way. Okay, we might give them what they require, but a tally has to be kept. Why? Because someday, that corporation may, as many of them have been doing, come to us and say, like, for example, as I noted on a previous program, the Pfizer drug company told the American people it's leaving the United States and converting into a British corporation, thereby never paying huge taxes it would have had to pay if it ever brought back its last 5 years of profits to the United States, thereby paying taxes in the future to a Briton, even though for 150 years the Pfizer Corporation asked for and got all kinds of tax breaks and supports in this community, in that state, so on and so on. If we kept the tally, then we would say to Pfizer something like this. Okay, you want to go? You go. But you're going to have to pay back some accommodation for all of the public benefits given to you. Those benefits were given to you by a community you're now abandoning. And you're not free to leave without paying back some of what we gave you to stay. To say the same thing in plain English, we ought not to bail out a company or to give a company the freedom to go without getting something back. We live in a capitalism that not only gives out tax breaks and subsidies and builds highways and creates school curricula and a thousand other things to convenience, to benefit, and to help corporations. But when they announce that they're leaving to make money someplace else, we seem to be standing there with egg on our collective face, unable to imagine the possibility of saying, you're not going anywhere because this is not a one-way street where we give you breaks and subsidies, but when you decide to leave, we're not entitled to anything. The community that gave up things in order to help you is not entitled to get from you some kind of compensation. What are you talking about? That would be outrageous. Yeah? Well, that's the norm in the United States. We bailed out and lost $11.2 billion with General Motors. Does the government of the United States that used our tax monies to do that, do we have an interest in General Motors? Does the government own shares so as this bailed out company does well, we the people who enabled it to survive get a piece of what we enabled to survive? Or is the government and the taxpayer just the giver and the giver and the giver until the corporations we give to have had enough of us, abandon us, go to another country, and we're to say nothing. Boo! And that's it? I don't think so. I think the United States, the people of the United States, ought to be quite upset, not only with the corporations who leave to make more money and leave behind the lost jobs, the devastated communities. But we also ought to be upset with the politicians who permit that, who don't pass the laws that say a company that proposes to leave, we will now present that company with a tally of all the government supports over the years, all the taxpayer help that they got. And we'll say, okay, now some accommodation has to be, you're not just leaving. We didn't give you those supports so you could leave. We gave you those supports so you could stay. You've changed your mind? Okay. You want to leave? Okay. But you got to pay. You got to give back. Otherwise, we gave you support under false understandings, and we don't want that. I think that's a serious problem for this country, one that hasn't gotten anywhere near the attention that it deserves. Most Americans have a vague sense that the bailouts were a gift and that nothing was given back in exchange. We saved the General Motors Corporation. How nice. We didn't save the people who worked there. many of whom lost their jobs. We didn't save the city that enabled GM to become a powerhouse, Detroit. It's filed for bankruptcy. And we didn't demand of General Motors to give back something in acknowledgement of all it got. An amazing country that does that. Thank you for your attention. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Change.